Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn, is not joining us today, but tune in next week and she'll be back. Our guest today is Robert Clark. Robert is the author of 5 books of nonfiction and 5 novels, most recently the nonfiction book Dark Water, Flood and Redemption in the City of Masterpieces. He lives in New York City, and the book that we're talking about today is My Victorians, Lost in the 19th Century. And this is a book from the University of Iowa Press. And those of you who have listened to us much or who are listening in Iowa City or in Fairfield know that we're based here in Iowa. So we're always happy to get authors from the University of Iowa Press. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Robert.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about your writing history before we get into My Victorians. So have you been a writer all your life?
I've been, on and off. I had a kind of ill-fated flirtation with art school when I first, when I was about 19 and discovered I didn't have any talent. And then I went back and became an English major as God intended. And, graduated in that, went to graduate school for a few years, and that didn't quite work out. I don't think I had much of a calling to be a professor either. And what I ended up doing was writing food and wine and travel journalism for about not quite 10 years. And that was sort of through my late 20s and into my 30s. So I guess I was writing, but I was writing as a journalist rather than a author, putting that in quotation marks.
And what made you take the leap to writing books?
Well, I think partly because I'd sort of said everything that, I was tired of writing these short articles for magazines and newsletters and such about food. I guess I felt like I had something more to say. And James Beard, who, along with Julia Child, were the two iconic food writers, of the 60s, 70s, 80s. James Beard had just died. And I got the idea, well, I could write a biography of him, and I could also, weave in a history of eating in America through the 20th century by telling his life story. So that was the first book I wrote. I mean, again, a more journalistic kind of thing. I never went back to food writing, but I kind of felt like I said everything I had to say about that subject.
Then from there to novels, was that much of a stretch for you?
It seemed like it at the beginning. The book I wrote after the James Beard book was called River of the West. And that was more of a history book, but it was an impressionistic history book. Each chapter had to do with a certain character who had migrated to or was working along the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon. And when I got to writing some of those personal histories, I kind of felt like I was, like I was navigating the consciousness and point of view of these people who started to become more like characters than historical figures for me. And when I finished that book, I really missed doing that kind of thing. It was as though I didn't want to say goodbye to these people. Historically, they had died or moved on to something else, but I kind of wanted to stay with them. And I think that gave me an impulse to create characters and shape their lives, out of my own intentions and interests. So then I wrote my first novel. But yeah, I thought I had no business writing a novel. Really, one of my friends kept urging me, "Why don't you write a novel?" I said, "I can't write a novel. I don't know anything about plotting or dialogue or all that." And but finally I decided, well, okay, I'll give it a shot. And what I'll do is I'll write a chapter at a time. And I'll show each chapter as I write it to this friend of mine. And if he tells me to keep going, well, then maybe I'll keep going. And that's what happened. I gave him the first chapter, and he said, "Yeah, I'm interested. Keep going." And you know, after that process happened over the course of four or five chapters, I decided, well, what the heck? I might as well finish writing this thing. And that's how I got into novel writing. It was not something I ever thought I would do.
Really? But yeah. you've stuck with it because you've written now five novels.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us a little bit about the novels?
Yeah, the first one is called In the Deep Midwinter, and like most of my fiction, it's set in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I grew up. And I wouldn't say they're autobiographical, although they include aspects of people that were in my life, people I knew or family members. Anyway, that was set in the late 40s, early 50s, in Minnesota, and it's kind of a family drama, you know, probably a kind of family tragedy. Mm. If you will. I mean, I guess what you'd, it, you know, it was literary fiction,
right.
I guess you'd call it. And then the novel after that was called Mr. White's Confession, which maybe wasn't a mystery, but it was kind of written in that mode and from a kind of noirish perspective, also set in St. Paul, and set in the late 1930s and then more generally up through the 60s. Then continuing in the sort of St. Paul trilogy, I wrote something called Love Among the Ruins, which was set entirely in 1968. And it was from the point of view of two teenagers who are having a love affair and eventually decide to run away together. More of St. Paul. That one was maybe a little bit more autobiographical because I'd always, I was around as a teenager in 1968.
Right.
And I'd had a certain kind of fantasy that I guess a lot of people did at that time of running away to San Francisco or doing something like that.
Becoming a hippie.
Right. Yeah. So there was a little bit of autobiography in that. Should I keep going describing these novels?
That's fine. But I'm just curious. It does seem like both in your nonfiction and your fiction, you are mostly looking to the past.
Mm-hmm.
Have you written anything that was really looking at contemporary, you know, that was set in the contemporary time?
Not much. I wrote one novel called Lives of the Artists, which was set in modern day Florence. It's about what in Seattle, where I lived for 25 years, it's about what we called Microsoft millionaires, people who got started at say Microsoft or Adobe or something in their 20s. And through stock options, by the time they were 35, you know, had made enough money where they were never going to have to work again. Mm-hmm. You know, so they'd move to Paris or they'd move to Italy or whatever, and maybe pursue the creative vocations that they felt they had when they were 18 or 20. And that's the kind of book. I don't know what you call it. It's a kind of tragicomedy or a tragedy of errors or something like that. It's meant to be funny.
So it's a novel.
Anyways,
but was it based? I mean, do you know some of these people?
I do know some people like that. In fact, one of them decided that it was about him and his wife, which it was not, and never spoke to me again.
Just curious. Four people that had that experience, did life become this wonderful adventure where they could pursue their passions and be happy, or did they create problems for themselves?
Yeah, they created problems for themselves.
Yeah.
That's which I guess is probably not surprising.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
sometimes
all
when you get what you want, you don't like it.
Well, part of it is you've got this striving, this purpose, while you're striving for it, and then you get it, and it's like, is this all there is? You get the feeling, mm-hmm. the feeling of his, I think. But we all still have that dream, don't we? Of, mm-hmm. of if yeah. we only had this, if we only had this amount of wealth, or we only had this amount of success or fame or fortune, mm-hmm. then everything would be peachy keen forever.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the, of course, the downside to that is when you say you've always dreamt of being an artist or perhaps a novelist. They're actually in this book. There's a person who wants, there are two people who there's a person who wants to be an artist and there's a person who wants to be a novelist. And, you know, but they've never had an opportunity to really do this stuff. And of course, when they get there, kind of like my own experience when I went to art school, they discover, you know, very reluctantly that they're actually not that good at it, or they haven't quite put in the, you know, the 10,000 hours or whatever, or it's not the life they dreamt of, and that living in Italy is an alien experience for them. They're not quite at home. They're mangling the language, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I guess the basic theme of that book is, you know, be careful what you wish for.
And for you...
So that's the one contemporary book I've read.
Okay. And for you, Robert, there is a little bit, you know, you write about this in My Victorians, that... You have a little bit of that experience too, because of your actual financial situation that allowed you the freedom to mm-hmm. to write without having to be concerned about making a living, and how that impacted
right.
you, the yeah. positives and the negatives. And I found that mm-hmm. very interesting.
Yeah, I inherited some money, not enough money to be rich, but enough money to get by. So I could just, I teach, so I do, you know, I do earn part of my living doing that. But enough money so I could write books without having to work at Starbucks, or, you know, teach composition at a community college or something like that. So
right.
yeah, that's and that's very much in the mix. And yeah, there are that has ups and downs.
Yeah, and you know, the benefits seem obvious, but tell us a little mm-hmm. bit about the drawbacks to that.
Well, I think you're constantly under, you're at least in my case, there are two avenues people take with this, which is that, at least in my experience, which is that they do nothing. You know, they just party. And, you know, and feel aimless and
dissatisfied
about that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or alternatively, they work very hard because they have this sense that they have been handed a gift that maybe they haven't earned. So they have to prove to the world that in fact they're a substantial, hardworking person. You know, even though in some ways a livelihood, a way of life has been handed to them. And that's my experience with those sorts of people. And in my case, it was much more about work. That slight sense that there's no equivalency between the hours you put in and what you get uh-huh. in return for that. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, in our society, sometimes it seems like there's a reverse relationship between the value and effort of work and the reward for it.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's also a tremendous need, at least with the sort of people I know, particularly, I think maybe the boomer generation, to exaggerate how much one works. I always find that people are. Are talking about how, you know, oh, I put in 10 or 12 hours yesterday. And if you actually went to their office, you'd find out they weren't there. A sociologist friend of mine actually did that once.
Or they're there, but they're cruising the internet for a couple hours or,
you know,
of time.
Or in fact, they're just flat out making it up. They've gone home at 5 or 6 o'clock, you know, just like everybody has. So, you know, we tie up a lot of our worth, not our financial worth, but our psychological and social worth.
Yeah,
with that stuff.
That is true. And yeah. And our feeling of, do we deserve, let's say we do make a lot of money, we feel like we have to make sure everyone knows how much we worked for that.
Mm-hmm. It's the same way in which virtually any American, at least who's living above the poverty line, will claim to be middle class. And in places like Seattle, you've got people who are earning, who are earning $200,000 plus a year, describing themselves as middle class. Well, I'm sorry, you're not. But part of that is to say, part of that is saying, well, I'm just ordinary folks.
Yeah.
And maybe not being very comfortable with the amount of money they're earning. That whole subject comes up in my Victorian.
Yes, it does.
In the context of me writing about Dickens' last novel, or last complete novel, called Our Mutual Friend, which is pretty much entirely about money and greed and being a skinflint, or being extravagant, or being a wastrel. All those things, and money's a big thing in Victorian fiction. People are always waiting around for their great expectations, they're going to inherit money. That's the proper way to have money, at least in the social world in Victorian novels. It's funny, it's almost the reverse.
It is,
of my situation or the 20th century. It's like, if you earn it by dirtying your hands, that's not as desirable.
But now that's the best way to get
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Robert Clark, author of My Victorians, Lost in the 19th Century. Now, this book is a hybrid. I'm going to read this from the website, the U of I Press website. My Victorians is a hybrid in both form and content, part memoir, extended lyric essay, but also a work of biography, photography, and cultural, literary, and art history, and I'd even add a little bit of literary and art criticism in there. This is a travelogue of writer Robert Clark's attempt to work through a sudden and inexplicable 5-year-long obsession focused on Victorian novelists, artists, architecture, and critics. And when I was reading this, and I was thinking, okay, so what, this is a different than most memoirs. What is this like? And it's funny that you said that you used to write food journalism, because I was thinking about some of the food writers that I've known in the past, or that I've read in the past, who combine recipes with memoir and history of food and cultural observances and so forth. I'm thinking of Laurie Colwyn, I think her name
mm-hmm,
was.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. There was someone earlier than that, Elizabeth. Somebody, can't remember her last name.
Elizabeth David, maybe.
Yes, and
and James Beard wrote a book like that too.
Did he? Okay,
he wrote that one.
So it's interesting that that is part of your sort of background in writing. So inexplicable, sudden and inexplicable obsession with My Victorians. How did it come upon you?
Well, I started reading Victorian novels. I started looking at Victorian art and architecture. And just one thing spun off into another. And it really was kind of inexplicable. I'm still not sure, I'm still not sure exactly how I landed on that. I've always been a little bit obsessive. I always, from just when I was a little kid, you know, I'd get interested in something and I would just drill down into it, you know, for the next couple of years and, you know, and do practically nothing else. You know, my mom used to say, you know, Robert is boring into yet another, you know.
What were some of the subjects you bored into as a child?
Oh, you know, dinosaurs.
Of course.
Chemistry, space travel. You know, I mean, all pretty conventional stuff. But
right,
I suspect I did it with an intensity that most kids weren't doing. Photography was a big thing at one point, and religion. You know, learning about religion, and then later on, you know, joining a religion. Whereas I've been raised, you know, you could say pretty much outside of any church. We were nominally Unitarians, but nominally. And you know, and I don't quite know where that came from. One of the main themes of my Victorians has to do with loss of faith. You know, with realizing that, you know, with realizing that maybe what you thought you believed is actually a kind of fascination, you know, rather than some kind of commitment.
Yeah, I didn't realize how in flux religious beliefs were during the Victorian age. It makes sense because of Darwinism and spiritualism and all these other kind of things that came to the forefront there. But people actually were leaving religion, becoming agnostic, and switching religions. And you talk a lot about Anglo-Catholicism and Roman Catholicism. Now, is Anglo-Catholicism the same as Anglican?
It is, but it's what you'd call high church Anglicanism, which means it's much closer, both theologically and liturgically, you know, in terms of ceremonies and rites and so forth, to Roman Catholicism. You know, they wear vestments and have incense and chanting and the whole, you know, the whole nine yards. You know, sometimes more than Roman Catholics do.
The Church of England? Is that form of Anglican? Okay.
Yeah. That's what the Church of England is. The Anglican Church, and it, you know, it covers a whole gamut of everything from very bare bones, Bible-based, you know, preaching-based religion, all the way up to incredibly elaborate ritualistic worship.
So all under the same organization, essentially, the same hierarchy?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Episcopal Church in the United States is the branch of Anglicanism in America.
You know, okay. And, you know, we know about the kind of the history of Protestantism and Roman Catholicism in England in the, Henry VIII time, is, of course, when the split happened, and then in the Elizabethan time, you know, it was a huge conflict between the two. Did that conflict still exist during Victorian times?
It existed in the sense that there'd always been this, you know, there'd always been this sense that maybe at least for some people, that the Reformation had been a mistake, you know, that it was an expedient thing that Henry did so he could get his divorce or divorces. And so, you know, there was always, Catholicism was considered kind of threatening and subversive, you know, from the Tudor period onward, up until maybe the early 19th century, the early Victorian, you know, period. You know, Catholics were around, but they were worshiping in secret, this sort of thing. One of the things that happened in the Victorian period was that Catholicism was made legal, in Britain. So the Catholics came, you know, Catholics came out, built churches, cathedrals, etc. And it's interesting that in this period, you know, as you said, that where a lot of people are losing their faith, or their faith feels kind of up in the air to them, is that half the people tend to go in the direction of agnosticism, or even atheism, and it seems like the other half go in the direction of Catholicism. You know, they either want no religion, or they want a very intense ritualistic, authoritarian kind of religion, you know, where there isn't much questioning of what's going on. There's not a lot in the middle, at least, you know, not the people that you read about. It's like people are having a crisis of faith, so they're either going to, you know, go in deeper, or they're going to, you know, they're going to walk away.
Now, my Victorians,
and at least the people I write about,
my Victorians has 5 chapters, and each of them is sort of focused on one group of Victorian, you know, artists, you know, mm-hmm. of some form. And were these, when you say my Victorians, I'm thinking these were the men and women who were your Victorians. What about these particular people drew you to them? Some of them are ones that are very well known, like Charles Dickens and Virginia Woolf. Some are people I had never heard of. What drew you to these particular Victorian personages?
Well, I guess like everybody else, I started with Victorian novels. Then I started looking at Victorian art and architecture. And that led me to the first character in the book, John Ruskin, who was you could say he was one of the first art historians anywhere. Not just in Britain. And he was a critic and a tastemaker, and was responsible for promoting Gothic architecture, for promoting the painting of Turner, which people thought was, you know, was proto-abstract, and, you know, which people thought was absolutely insane at the time, you know, that, you know, showing people why Turner was important. He also may be more controversially from our point of view, or at least our taste nowadays, was big on a group of painters called the Pre-Raphaelites, you know, who did a kind of hyper realistic, you know, intensely chromatic kind of painting, you know, landscapes, scenes from literature, et cetera, et cetera. And the first chapter of the book is about Ruskin and a couple of painters who painted in that mode. So anyway, that's how I got into the art side of it. That's how I got into Ruskin and sort of his milieu.
But it's very much about his personal relationships too.
Oh yeah, you know, very much about it. You know, the one thing most people know about Ruskin, I shouldn't say most people, but, you know, but people who know about Ruskin, the one thing they tend to know doesn't have much to do with his work. It has to do with his unconsummated marriage to a woman named Effie. You know, unconsummated. They stayed together for a few years, and then the marriage was annulled. And the explanation that most people have heard for why Ruskin was unwilling to sleep with her is he had never seen pubic hair before. He had only seen classical statuary, you know, where there's no hair. And he was
appalled.
I think he was appalled by her person is the phrase that I can't remember if he used or is supposedly, you know, what he said about it. In fact, we don't know, you know, that to me seems unlikely. And I quote a lot of stuff in the book that shows that they just were not on the same page at all. They had virtually nothing to say to each other. You know, they had hugely different personalities. So that's the story of the fact that that Ruskin wouldn't sleep to her, that's been told a lot. In fact, there was a movie about it a couple of years ago with Elle Fanning as as Effie, and I can't remember who plays Ruskin. And it's completely based on the premise that it was the pubic hair. I'm not so sure about that.
It seems more likely that he might have been homosexual.
Yeah, he might. Yeah. Well, he also had like a lot of Victorian men. I don't think he was a pedophile. Mm. But he had a thing about little girls.
Mm. Like just, a lot, you know, of Victorian men. This was a common
thing? Like, yeah. Yeah, like, you know, well, Lewis Carroll would be the, you know, would be the, you know,
the poster boy for that.
Right. And then, you know, but there's also a poet I write about briefly named Coventry Patmore, who wrote the most popular poem of the Victorian period. It wasn't Tennyson. It was Coventry Patmore. And it was called The Angel in the House, which, if you've done feminist studies, you might have heard about. It's written about his wife, you know, who is an adult, but the whole thing is written, the whole thing is portraying her as a, you know, as a virginal, perfect, essentially little girl, I would argue. So it's a Victorian thing. We don't have much evidence that there was actually, any pedophilia at all with these guys. But it definitely is there, and I don't think it was thought of as terribly odd at the time. But I certainly think that Ruskin's sexual interests lay elsewhere, or that he was asexual.
Right.
I don't think it was the pubic hair.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Robert Clark, author of My Victorians: Lost in the 19th Century. So, Robert, you became very interested in this. You were reading Dickens, Our Mutual Friend, and, which I'd like to talk about a little more. But you actually then went and lived in England a while to sort of pursue this obsession.
Yeah, I went for a total of, I made two trips, one for 2 months and one for 3 months. And I should say I had spent a lot of time in England in the past. I had gone to graduate school there. Mm. So early on in my, you know, in my 20s and early 30s, I had ended up living there for a total of, I guess, 7 years. So it's not like it was unfamiliar territory for me. But, you know, once I left graduate school, it's not like I particularly was an Anglophile or was going back there all the time. But I did have some background.
And you made lists of all these different places you wanted to visit and photograph were places where these various people had lived or worked or set their novels.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a method to that, to what, you know, which places you chose?
Well, it was, you know, they tended to be, you know, they were people I admired or was interested in some way. And then there'd be a lot of research trying to find out where they lived. And this, for some reason in itself, was an obsession. It was what a friend of mine calls my literary stalking. You know, I would go and find somebody's house and stand outside, and then I would go back and photograph it. But it was for some reason very important for me to be in the same space as these people were. Just as important as, say, reading their books or looking at their paintings or whatever else. It's like I was sort of, kind of tracking these people down and sort of, building this list of trophies or something like that.
And all the while, you were writing for the book.
Mm-hmm.
Did you... the whole time that this was going on, were you thinking, oh, this, there's a book in here? And
not initially, no. I mean, I thought I might write some essays, about it. In fact, I think I wrote an essay that didn't end up, in the book, about another of, 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 um, of a Dickens novel. The novel's the name is escaping me right now. And so, you know, so I thought I might write something about it, but at that point it was a kind of, you know, stalking or sort of tourism or, you know, taking photographs. I didn't actually write any of the book till I'd done all that stuff.
Okay.
So actually I was doing all this stuff and making a lot of notes and doing a lot of research and taking all the photographs, but I didn't actually sit down and start writing till afterwards.
And also at the same time, online dating.
Yeah, and the book, among other things, is about, you know, I mean, the one sort of contemporary aspect of it is the online dating thing. When I got over to England, I got on the Guardian dating website and went on a fair number of dates. And I'm afraid most of them ended up kind of comically or awkwardly. Probably because I wasn't really living in the current century.
You weren't really planning to stay in England forever either. So there was.
Well, I thought I might. Oh, you know, if I met the right person.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean that. You know, that was an option, or at least I thought it was. I mean, I think in retrospect I realized that certainly a lot of this kind of immersion, which you could almost say was also a kind of evasion and a kind of hiding out, had to do with the fact that my life had been unraveling at several levels. I'd been through a divorce. You know, I was losing my faith. My literary career hadn't been going in the direction I had hoped it would. There was a lot of stuff going on, and I think I took refuge, in this Victorian world, this world that doesn't exist anymore. Like I was living in this kind of alternate sort of world that's inhabited by ghosts, really. It's not inhabited by contemporary British people, you know, or the contemporary British women that I was trying to date.
You had an experience where it seems like you almost pierced the veil into the Victorian world.
I've been reading about George Gissing, whose most famous book is called New Grub Street, and who, you know, who just struggled with his literary career over his whole life and made bad choices about women as well. And somehow I related to all that. I was reading his diaries while I was there. He was a miserable cuss. You know, he'd just say another lousy day, threw away 8 pages, endless misery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So of course I was getting into all that too. And I was going to photograph the places he'd lived, and he was moving all the time. So there were quite a few. And, one of them was on Swinton Street, which is near King's Cross Station, maybe just on the boundaries of Bloomsbury. And I had a kind of I don't know if you'd say a kind of breakdown, but I went, you know, but I had this experience that lasted for about 30 seconds where I really felt like the buildings were kind of closing in on me, and I was getting slightly out of control. I was going slightly nuts, and then I snapped out of it. But yeah, that really kind of threw me. And I guess for the rest of the time I was there, I kept wondering, what was that about? And I guess you're right. Maybe I did sort of pierce through the veil and entered that Victorian world. And I didn't like it very much when I got there. You know, I found it kind of dislocating. Yeah. You know, but it didn't stop the obsession. The obsession continued for at least another year or so after that.
Well, Robert, why don't you read a little bit from My Victorians?
Okay, I'm going to read a little bit about one of my online dates, which gets into the subject of one of the most famous Victorian paintings, The Light of the World by William Holman Hunt. And I go on this date, and my date has rather different feelings about that painting than I do.
Okay.
So when I'd left my home in Seattle for England, I had more in mind than research. I'd been divorced 5 years and been dating online, but without much success. But in London, I thought I might have better luck with my interests and in a large population center full of artists, intellectuals, scholars, and writers. There ought to be more suitable types than I found in Seattle, and not a few fellow Victorianists. That was the card I played most heavily when I posted a profile on the dating site of The Guardian. And my profile read as follows. I'm American, a transatlantic commuter, not exactly an innocent abroad, but despite quite a few years resident in Europe, someone whose Midwestern roots show in the manner of one of F. Scott Fitzgerald Gatsby characters, naively bruised but with a capacity for London, still intact, rowing sometimes unwisely against the current. I'm also an author of both novels and nonfiction and teach creative writing in a university MFA course. And I'm pretty free to live where and how I please, generally depending on whatever writing project I'm pursuing. My latest obsession is Victoriana, or really Victoromania, chiefly my own, which has crept up on me over the last decade and seems in many ways inexplicable, but extends to art, architecture, novels, Ruskin, Gissing, Dickens, Gaskell, Christina Rossetti, trains and ruins, etc. Also recently crazy about Forster, Mansfield, Bowen, and Taylor. I'm open to putting down deeper roots in England. My ancestors emigrated from Suffolk in London 300 years ago, but what's a few years hiatus? At present, I'm here for about 6 months a year, but should I meet someone special? ... And, that was my ad, which strikes me as really, I don't know, I'm cringing a little bit. And it ends up saying, need music, classical, art song, much more, films, espresso, wine, humor, and books to function. And who knows, maybe you. You don't have to wear a bonnet and muslin, but I wouldn't mind if you were pretty, fit, and happy in your vocation and busy finding your heart's desire. That's the end of the bio.
And you seem to get quite a few responses too. Oh, but go ahead.
Yeah. I got a lot, but I'll read a little further, and we'll get into an actual date here. I hadn't quite thought though what would happen if anyone responded, if I was really prepared to move 5,000 miles for the right person. But I was joining the site on a lark with no expectations, or so I told myself. If anyone replied, I'd be clear about my situation, or at least I might make a friend. But there were quite a few responses, particularly from art historians, museum curators, and scholars and fans of Victorian history, literature, and art. I'd imagined my own Victoromania to be a pretty singular thing. Maybe, in truth, I liked it that way. It made me special and eccentric in my own fashion, in, when you got down to it, a Victorian way. Now I discovered that I wasn't alone. Reading their emails and gazing at their photos, I saw that there were women I could share my obsession with, and maybe become lovers too. Victoromania plus companionship plus sex. For these, I would compromise my eccentricity. And if I had no luck, I'd still have my solitude, my books, and my camera, my private world. My first date was with a feminist art historian, Annie, not exactly a Victorianism, a Victorianist, but funny and incisive. We bantered and laughed a lot on our first two dates, though she was a bit incredulous when I mentioned that I taught writing at a church-affiliated university. She wondered what sort of nonsense I believed, still more how art and the creative process could be taught and flourish in such an environment. I hastened to explain that I wasn't one of them, that when I'd applied for the job, I'd suggested otherwise, played along, gone through the motions. In fact, on the job application and contract, I'd pretty much happily assented to the bulk of Christian dogma without much compunction, knowing that any number of adherents struggled with the same doubts. I didn't quite believe, but I didn't quite not believe, not enough to renounce it in a thoroughgoing way, except over dinner with an attractive woman. I let her construe whatever she wanted about my not being one of them. If she pressed me further, I'd tell myself and her I was being nuanced rather than evasive. Art, among other things, was surely about nuance. On our second date, we'd done some passionate kissing in her car when she dropped me off at my flat. So this date, our third, might culminate in something, summitus or undoous. That was the night of the day I'd gone to Oxford and communed with Ruskin, Millay, and Holman Hunt. I gave her a full report, showing her my dyspeptic selfie in front of the light of the world, and we had a good laugh. But when I went on about Ruskin's, what I really went on about was Ruskin's study of gneiss, or gneiss, it's a kind of rock. She looked at the shot I'd taken. She looked at the shot I'd taken of the drawing with my phone and shook her head. He didn't add anything with this. Didn't advance art in any way, she said. It was an illustration, a meticulous rendering that was no more than the sum of its parts. I argued with her. I said maybe she was partially right. It was photographic, everything was foreground, and that represented a way of seeing that was strange and new at the time, but familiar to us. But it involved Ruskin's own dictum of truth to nature, of, quote, seeing things as they are, unquote, made manifest. He'd argued, in fact, that no kind of observation was more fundamental to art than geology. But Annie was unswayed, and I sensed impatient. I went back to the light of the world in hopes of easing the mood, but not to much effect. We'd already been over that, and the evening had seized up at some earlier moment. I didn't bring up Holman Hunt anymore. When she dropped me off, we didn't kiss. We met a week later. Over dinner, I also told her that I was going back to America in 2 weeks, something I was sure I'd already mentioned, that I'd made explicit. She said, though, that I'd misled her about my intentions. She looked angry and also hurt. She felt something, which was something I hadn't planned on. I never heard from her again. So that's one of many, many misguided dates. And, you know,
well, it must have been somewhat flattering, though, to attract so many women willing to go out with you.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, because that hadn't been happening in the States. You know, maybe it was that I was in this very large city and I was immersing myself in its history. I don't know. Yeah, it kind of puzzled me. You know, like, as I say, most of them ended, you know, most of them ended after one or two, one or two meetings. And perhaps it was because they realized I wasn't all there. I was living in another time and I wasn't sure if I was going to stay there or not.
Right.
I was neither here nor there, both chronologically and geographically.
Now, this painting, The Light of the World, really, your feelings about that painting come up over and over again in this book. What is it about that painting that is so so important to you in not necessarily a positive way?
Well, I think it has to do with this whole question of why am I so obsessed with this period and with these sorts of artists and writers, because my personal reaction to it, you know, as somebody who's studied some art history and, you know, admires modern and postmodern and contemporary art, is that, oh my God, this is an awful painting. You know, it's in these bright sort of candy colored tints. It's, you know, it seems deeply sentimental. The head's too small for the body. And it's just everything treacly, you know, that people don't like about what they imagine is the Victorian world. On the other hand, it's the most popular painting of the Victorian era. And, you know, it's certainly by ordinary people, but also by some pretty sophisticated people. So what am I supposed to make of that? You know, I have all this admiration for people like John Ruskin, and yet this painting I just think is, you know, is pretty awful. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to put myself in, you know, in the shoes of Victorian admirers of this painting and try to figure out, you know, what they saw in it and why I can't see it. Because I'm doing pretty well with the other stuff. You know, I'm doing pretty well with the novels and the architecture and some of the other artists, but this painting is like, it's the fly in the ointment. You know, it's the thing that doesn't compute.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the book you have a photograph of the painting, but it's a black and white photograph, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I don't...
Which is too bad.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, that's not so bad. But now I just pulled it up online on my computer mm-hmm. when you said it had these, you know, the colors, and I'm like, oh, I see what he means. Yeah, the colors of it are garish.
Yeah, they are. And of course, it's interesting that all these artists, you know, following Ruskin's dictum, are trying to render the world as it is, which also makes me wonder, did they really see things in Technicolor? Maybe they did. Maybe perception changes along with everything else.
So, Robert, how, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, how you started writing nonfiction and then novels and so forth. Was your path to publication an easy one or a rocky one?
To tell you the truth, it was fairly easy because I had been, I'd been working as a food writer at that, for 7, 8 years, and I'd published in some pretty decent places, and I knew a lot of people. I had a very good network. So, I had some, I had some qualifications to write about food. And my first book was about food. It was about James Beard. So, so it wasn't really a hard sell. I had to produce an outline and a proposal and and all that stuff that you always have to do when you're pitching a book to an editor. But I didn't have to fight my way, through the door, because I knew people and I had qualifications to do this. So, that wasn't so difficult. And, and the next book, the book I wrote after that, River of the West, which was another nonfiction book, again, I didn't have to, it was not on the subject that I had been writing about for all those years. But the James Beard book had done pretty well, at least critically, and it had won a few awards and stuff like that. So again, I was kind of a known quantity. It's not like the publisher was gambling on an unknown. Not the first novel, I did have a lot of trouble selling. I think it, went out to about, it went out to like maybe 20, 25 different publishing houses before somebody bought it. So that, that was more of a battle, to get that into print, which, in a way didn't surprise me because, I'd already been thinking like, what am I doing? Who am I to try to write a novel? So I wasn't necessarily surprised. And then again, when the novel came out, it did pretty well, at least critically. So the novels I wrote after that were not so difficult to publish. And I've always kind of alternated between I write a novel, I write a nonfiction book, I write another novel, and I write another nonfiction book. So.
And the your Mr. White's Confession, was that the second one you novel that you wrote?
That was the second
And
novel
that
I wrote.
received
And that,
an Edgar Award for
yeah,
best
which really
novel.
surprised me. Which really surprised me because I didn't really think of it as a mystery when I was writing it. I thought of it as literary fiction that had some pastiches of mystery and film noir and stuff in it. And that book, won some awards and got good reviews, and it also sold. It's really the only book of mine that ever really sold much. So, which also gave me which also gave me more freedom to just write. Because, as I said, I had a little bit of family money, but not quite enough to just write. And that
So,
got optioned by the movies and stuff like that. So that really changed, was it changed my fortunes a lot.
but you didn't like think, okay, this is where I'm going to have success, so I'm going to write more books like this.
Well, once, I was really sure I couldn't write a mystery, and I kind of still believe that the whole mystery in Mr. White's Confession, such as it is, is revealed in the middle of the book.
Oh, wow.
There's always a, I mean, there's always a faint suggestion that maybe it's not been solved. I kind of leave the reader hanging a little bit, leaving things a little ambiguous. So the idea that I could cook up another plot that would be a classic, procedural or whatever else was, I've been racking my brain ever since because, it would be, I enjoyed that character and I certainly enjoyed the success of the book, but, I'm still kind of racking my brain. I'm reading a lot of mysteries right now because I think well, I should take another shot at that. But it's just not catching. I'm thinking, what is the plot? You know, it needs to have a real plot point.
Not that easy to come up with, is it? Unless, mysteries, it's all very kind of formulaic. But if you're trying to write something that's not just like everything else, it's not that easy.
Yeah. No, and the plot of Mr. White was based on some real life stuff, which I never would have cooked up on my own.
Ah.
You know, it was a combination of a very odd relative that I had that I'd always been very puzzled by, and the O.J. Simpson case, which was going on at the time.
Okay, that sounds pretty fascinating.
I kind of combined those things together, you know, as a jumping off point, and that's how that book got written.
Wow. Now, is My Victorians the only memoirish book that you've written?
No, I wrote, I'd say I've written three books that are memoirish. My Victorians, but then I also, early on, I wrote a book called My Grandfather's House, which was about my own religious life and that of my family. And I went back, you know, like to the 1400s. I did a lot of research and genealogy and stuff because I was interested that I came from this family that started out as medieval Roman Catholics, you know, like everybody in the Middle Ages was in Europe, and then became Protestants, and then moved to the New World and were Puritans, and then became Unitarians and agnostics and atheists, and, you know, up to my life, and, you know, where I variously called myself a atheist, an agnostic, a Zen Buddhist, a Episcopalian, a Catholic, and just somebody who's very confused. That's where I am now. I'm in the just very confused position about that stuff. So that was a memoir. And then the book Dark Water, which is about the 1966 flood in Florence, Italy, also has a kind of memoir thread running through it. I mean, I'm reporting the history, but I'm also talking about how I'm writing the book and, you know, how I'm getting into the subject and how I'm meeting people and things, and, you know, how I'm slaughtering the Italian language and things like that. And what I ate in Florence. All the good food.
Well, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for being here with us, Robert.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. And I was looking for a quote by Dickens to finish out because we always end with a quote on Writer's Voices. Usually my mom comes up with it, but she's not here today. So here is a Charles Dickens quote about writing. There are books of which the backs and covers are by far the best parts. But
I like that. I hope it's not true of this one.
I
wonderful.
Don't think it is true that. Of this one. Definitely not. So thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices. Thank you.